From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As you know by now, a jury found 18-year-old Illinois man Kyle Rittenhouse not guilty of all charges after he shot and killed two people and maimed a third during unrest in Kenosha, Wisconsin last summer. The demonstrations came after the police there shot Jacob Blake. Like so much in America today, reaction to the verdict was polarized. Many politicians on the right lauded Rittenhouse's acquittal, calling it a victory for self-defense laws and gun rights. The NRA tweeted the text of the Second Amendment 15 minutes after the verdict, and Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida and Madison Cawthorn of North Carolina offered Rittenhouse congressional internships. But many on the other side of the political spectrum found the verdict to be unjust, offering a green light to other would-be vigilantes, and symbolic of racial double standards in our justice system. One of our listeners, Candace, left us a voicemail on this very point.
When in American history has an African-American man ever walked down the street with an AK-47 and killed two people and lived to talk about it, let alone been cleared of all charges? Khalif Browder was sent to Rikers Island for 3 years for allegedly stealing a book bag. He was 17. Trayvon Martin was 17 years old when he was walking down the street with Skittles in his pocket, and he was gunned down. His murderer is still walking free because of our U.S. justice system. And this is why we need to vote these judges out of their seats and elect a judicial system that will be fair and just to all of its citizens. No, justice was not served. And my heart truly goes out to the families of these victims.
Meanwhile, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker issued a statement that said, in part, carrying a loaded gun into a community 20 miles from your home and shooting unarmed citizens is fundamentally wrong. It's a tragedy that the court could not acknowledge that basic fact. We must do better than this, unquote. Other listeners expressed confusion about how a 17-year-old could bring a high-powered rifle to a protest area, kill two and injure another, and yet legally commit no crime.
This is Terry calling from Champaign. That somehow two people were shot and killed and a third badly maimed, and the shooter broke no laws, says to me there's something seriously wrong with our country and its approach to justice.
Joining us now to discuss the case and the verdict are April Prayer, who's a criminal defense attorney based in Chicago. April, thank you for coming on.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
We're also joined by Mark Brown, who's a columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times. Mark, good to talk with you again. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Brian.
And Deneen Smith is a reporter for the newspaper Kenosha News. She was in the courtroom for the trial. Deneen, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Thanks.
Listeners, our lines are open for this segment at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And we want to hear from you. What do you think about the verdict in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse? Do you think justice was served? The jury get it right? Did it get it wrong? Where were the problems if you don't think justice was served? We can take your calls and questions at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. So, Denny, I'm going to begin with you. You've been covering the trial from the courtroom in Kenosha. I found your tweets to be invaluable in keeping up with this hour by hour. So can you just tell us what was it like in the courtroom as the jury announced its, or I should say the not guilty verdict of the jury was announced?
You know, the courtroom, it was pretty tense waiting. You know, as we knew the verdict was in, but we're waiting for the jury to come out. You could see Kyle Rittenhouse's defense attorney's legs shaking in front of me. And as soon as the first not guilty was announced on the first count, Kyle Rittenhouse's legs kind of went out from under him. And his mother, who was sitting a couple rows behind me, started to cry. And across the aisle from me, Anthony Huber's girlfriend, started to cry as well. So it was a pretty emotional and tense moment.
And how have things been in Kenosha following the verdict through today?
I think they've been very calm. And I think, you know, there was a lot of people that were worried that there would be some unrest following the verdict. You could kind of hear from inside the courtroom some folks shouting outside when news got outside of the verdict. But it was quiet. There was a small presence of protesters on both sides of the issue throughout the trial, but it was really pretty small, and it's been very subdued here afterwards. I think there's been, you know, much larger protests in other cities about the verdict than there has been here.
So one of our listeners sent us a text message. This is someone goes by M from our Text the 21st group, and they said, "I have thought from the beginning that the judge had an agenda and behaved in a way that requires a mistrial," end quote. You know, Deneen, throughout the trial, a lot has been made about Judge Schroeder's perceived conduct. I thought it was interesting, you as a local reporter, this is not the first time you've been in his courtroom, unlike a lot of the national reporters who were covering this case. And you've tweeted about how some of the things that have been scrutinized, like having that "Proud to Be an American" song as his ringtone, you know, that's pretty typical of him, that certainly predates this trial or anything like that. Can you talk about how he handled this case compared to past cases you've covered in his courtroom?
Sure. I've been covering courts here in Wisconsin for about, or in Kenosha County for about 5 or 6 years. And throughout that time, Judge Schroeder has always covered criminal courts. So I've spent a lot of time in his courtroom. I thought that he conducted himself in this case like he would typically. I think that he tends as a judge locally, I think, to be viewed by criminal defense attorneys as a judge that will give you a very fair trial if you're going to go to trial on a case, and that he's perceived as very tough as a sentencing judge, or perhaps a little bit unpredictable as a sentencing judge. So maybe more difficult for criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors to come to plea agreements, which is where most criminal cases go. But in terms of some of the things that really struck people in this case, for example, the victims, you know, not calling people victims and making them be referred to as complaining witnesses. That is his standard for his courtroom. He does that on all cases at trial. I think the issue with the, you know, there was a lot made of the pretrial motion on the being able to call people rioters and looters. I think that was perhaps slightly misconstrued. I think that he was saying, you know, you can see where the evidence takes you. He wasn't saying, yes, of course you can call them this. So, you know, he's an eccentric judge. He's an outspoken person. He tends to do a lot of asides about history and about the criminal justice system. But I didn't see him as being, you know, as someone who sits in his courtroom a lot, I did not see him as being biased towards this defendant, but rather as handling it like he typically handles trials.
Not sort of preening for the cameras, knowing this was a high profile case or anything. It's the way he is.
No, I really didn't see that. I saw him, you know, acting as he sort of typically does.
All right, April Prey, I want to bring you in. You're a criminal defense attorney, and you're accustomed to being on that sort of that side of the courtroom. I'm curious what your reaction to the verdict was.
I wasn't at all surprised. I was disappointed as it pertained to the Rosenbaum counts, because what we're taught in terms of the letter of the law, in terms of what Black's Law Dictionary says, what we're taught in law school, is that self-defense means force matched force. Meaning if we are in a fist fight, that if you suddenly grab a bottle, that then the force is uneven. If I suddenly pull a knife and you have nothing in your hands, that the force is uneven. So it was very hard for me to wrap my head around how the jury reached the conclusion that it was self-defense with the situation with Rosenbaum, because at that point, Rittenhouse was not surrounded by a so-called angry mob. They were pretty much just the two of them off to themselves. I mean, there was a lot of commotion happening nearby, but there were just the two of them and Rosenbaum had no weapon. So I know that the defense argument was, well, what if he got his hands on Rittenhouse's weapon? But that's not what we saw. And I am fearful that it's already happening because defense attorneys are getting calls from clients with no viable self-defense claims who are now saying, well, you know, I didn't shoot three people. I only shot one person and that person was unarmed. So I should be able to walk like Rittenhouse did. So I'm fearful that we'll see more and more of that where people are simply losing a fight where their opponent is stronger and faster than they are. And maybe they're getting struck in the face or about the body and they suddenly pull a deadly weapon. And I think it is worth saying that this was not simply a pistol that was pulled. It was an assault rifle, and that Mr. Rosenbaum wasn't simply struck once to maim him and stop him. He was struck four times. So I think it's significant to say that force was really uneven in this situation. With the other two victims, it's easier to debate the whole matter of self-defense because of the skateboard and the pistol, and he was outnumbered. It's an easier claim for the defense to argue self-defense there. But I just am very fearful that people will look to this case, even though it's not precedent because it never went up on appeal, but they will look to this case and point to this case and say, but, what about the Rittenhouse case? You know, my facts are not as egregious as that. I should be able to argue self-defense and win on self-defense, even though, because we see this situation so often, people who are unarmed, who are shot, maimed, or killed by someone who has a weapon.
Mark Brown, I want to share with you a couple of our other listeners wrote us text messages. Juanita said, justice was done. Wes said, feelings do not matter here. Justice was served and we must move on whether we like the verdict or not. And then Jan wrote, this is a travesty. It is not justice. He was creating an intimidating situation by carrying such a weapon. Then he attacked those who responded defensively to him, then calls it self-defense. Not, is what Jan said. Mark, you've been writing about this case, and even before it went to the jury, you had a column in which the headline was, acquitting Rittenhouse would be the correct if unjust verdict. Can you talk about that, sort of the legal distinction and what maybe people were hoping for from this trial and the sort of broader sense of justice with a capital J?
Well, I guess what I was trying to get at is, if, you know, for one, I was not in the courtroom. I just watched it on court TV or a live stream, like a lot of people. But I could see where the evidence was going and what the jury's instructions were going to be, and it was, and what the law is in Wisconsin. It was pretty clear to me early on that this was headed for a not guilty verdict. And so that's, I started writing about that. And that frustrates me because, like a lot of people on the left side of the spectrum, that feels unjust, right? He did go in there and kill two people in a place he just had no business being. There was no good going to come of Kyle Rittenhouse being there that night. But that's not what the law is. So, I tried to express my sense that this isn't justice, but it seemed to me to be a correct verdict by that jury. And I'm very upset in the aftermath here that people aren't being more respectful of a decision by a jury. That if you don't listen to the trial beginning to end, understand all the facts, the evidence, and know what the law is as the jury is instructed, I mean, you got to have some faith in those people. And I think they made the reasonable call.
Yeah, having sat on a jury, it really is quite a different experience to actually hear every hour of the evidence that's presented as opposed to even covering it as a reporter or certainly following it in the newspaper or TV news or however people are consuming it. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce my guests. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. We're speaking with Mark Brown, who's a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, April Prayer, who is a criminal defense attorney based in Chicago, and Deneen Smith, a reporter for Kenosha News newspaper there in Kenosha, who covered the trial in the courtroom and has been in that courtroom for several years now. Covering other cases as well. If you want to join our conversation, we'd love to hear your comments on this. 800-222-9455 is the number to call. That's 800-222-9455. Do you think there was justice in this verdict? Did the jury get it right? Did the jury get it wrong? 800-222-9455. To Mark's point, he made just a minute ago about respecting the jury's view on this. Joe Biden, President Biden, issued a statement saying, look, I stand by what the jury has concluded. The jury system works, and we have to abide by it. Do you think that's the right sentiment? 800-222-9455. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break here on the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we're reacting to the verdict last Friday after we were off air for the week of in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. He was found not guilty, as you know, on all counts. We're talking about this with Deneen Smith, who's a reporter for the newspaper Kenosha News, Mark Brown, a columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times, and April Prayer, a criminal defense attorney based in Chicago. We want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And Deneen, I want to ask you what your perspective is. As I'm a reporter, or I should say back when I was a reporter, a newspaper reporter, I covered a three-week trial. And it was something that only at the end did a couple of people from the national media sort of parachute in, cover the closing arguments, and then write stories. And I kind of feel like they got the big picture wrong on that case. I'm wondering, what is your perspective as somebody in Kenosha of the coverage of this case, really going back to last summer and the unrest that happened there, too?
You know, I think that in a lot of ways, the national media got the Rittenhouse case really right. I think that, you know, as far as going back through the unrest of last year, there was, you know, perhaps, you know,
oop, and I think we lost Deneen's connection there on the Zoom, maybe a little interruption. So, April, let me bring you back into the conversation here. There was a piece in the Atlantic magazine in the last couple of days, sort of after the verdict, that said the Rittenhouse trial could never have been what Americans wanted. And we actually had a conversation about this here on the program as the trial was beginning, which is, you know, the public wanted this to sort of settle questions of, let's say, racial disparities and self-defense claims, for example, and how those, you know, white defendants are much more likely to get a favorable verdict to them than African-American defendants. Can you talk about, you know, what the idea the public maybe wanted something from this case that the court and the facts before the court could not provide? Or do you think that analysis is incorrect?
I don't know exactly what they mean by that quote, that the trial wouldn't give America what it wanted. I'm not sure what people wanted. I think people are still up in arms about the unrest of last year, that they saw this trial as a continuation of that, that they did want to see whether a white defendant would be treated the same as Black and Latino defendants. If he had lost, would he have received a sentence that was lighter than Black and Latino defendants, or would we be in the position that we're in now where he received a total acquittal on all counts? So I mean, honestly, the public is never satisfied with any high profile case and how it turns out. There will always be one half of the US that is angry and dissatisfied. So, I mean, that doesn't change much. What I think was interesting about this case was that oftentimes the commentary, it became a case about race, even though the defendant was white and all the victims were white. And I think that some of that stemmed from it happening as a result of a Black Lives Matter protest, whether the decedent and the other victim were there in support of Black Lives Matter or not. I still am unclear on that. But I think that in the mind of the public, they were associated with the Black Lives Matter and movement. And I think in some ways that made their lives matter less. And I think that, like you mentioned, the whole issue of white defendants always being treated better than Black defendants, almost always faring better than Black and Latino defendants, which I definitely have seen in my 22 years of trial experience in a very busy city, in a very busy county. You'll see, you know, I mean, we've all heard the stories, two defendants who are charged with the exact same thing with no background get very different outcomes just because of their race. So I think people were maybe looking for some sort of reckoning when it came to that, and they were not going to get that with this particular set of facts. It is a really strange set of facts, though, but they were not going to get it with this particular set of facts.
Mark, let me ask you about that. What do you have a sense of, I mean, was this, you know, there is this question that I think a lot of people are feeling was wrong here, of, and even in Governor Pritzker's statement, right? We read that earlier, the idea, I have it here. Governor Pritzker had said carrying a loaded gun into a community 20 miles from your home and shooting unarmed citizens is fundamentally wrong. It's a tragedy that the court could not acknowledge that basic fact. But Mark, that question wasn't really before the court, right? The wisdom of a 17-year-old.
Yeah, well, go ahead. I guess it was in a way, but that's sort of the problem here is that, you know, we have a set of laws and that are supposed to keep us flying right, and there just really was no law that would govern this except for the homicide laws. And for those, there was this self-defense claim. I mean, you can't get around the fact that you know, again, Rittenhouse brings a gun, a big gun that can kill people, but he wasn't out being the police at the moments he was shot. I mean, at the moments he shot people. He was being chased and attacked. I mean, that's the problem. That's what the jury in the end had to look at. And, you know, I understand April's point about matching force to force. I think I always had a similar understanding, but there was nothing like that. And Deneen can back me up on this. There's nothing in the jury instructions that would say that. And I don't have the jury instruction here in front of me, but it was, you know, whether he had reason to fear for imminent fear for safety or something like that. Now, maybe we need to tighten up the laws on self-defense, but that just wasn't there for the jury, you know.
Yeah, Deneen, go ahead. Yeah.
That's right. It's did the defendant at the time have, I don't have the wording exactly right, but a reasonable fear of imminent death or bodily harm. There's nothing about matching force to force in the jury instructions here in Wisconsin.
Okay. And Deneen, I know.
And remember that, ahead, I mean, it all starts with the Rosenbaum shooting, right? And in that, you know, there's conflicting versions of what happened there, but you know, at the moment that that Rosenbaum starts to chase after Rittenhouse and Rittenhouse starts running away, a guy that's standing right there with Rosenbaum right next to him shoots his gun in the air while Rittenhouse has his back turned to him. I mean, there would be fear. There would be fear going on there. And Rosenbaum clearly knew that Rittenhouse had this gun. He was chasing after him, you know, I think because he had the gun. And it created a very dangerous situation, as it turned out, more for him than for Mr. Rittenhouse. I, you know, one of the things I hate is that the defense argued that Rosenbaum would have got the gun and shot other people. There's no, who knows what he would have done with the gun. It's very convenient for them to argue that. I guess Rittenhouse even, as I recall, he even testified to that, that was on his mind. But, you know, it was a bad situation. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Deneen, I know you needed to leave us at 11:30, so thank you so much for being with us today here on the 21st. Deneen Smith is a reporter for the Kenosha News. Thank you. Thank you for making time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And we're going to continue with Mark Brown and April Prayer. 800-222-9455 is our number. Let's go now to the phones. Victor is calling in from Rockford. Victor, what do you make of the outcome in this case?
Well, I don't think that justice was served, but I think you have to look at the question of whether justice is what ought to be or whether or not the laws were followed. I am not an attorney, but from my understanding, the laws that were in effect at the time of the shooting provided an out for Kyle Rittenhouse, and he and his attorneys certainly took it. If there's going to be any kind of justice in the case, I think that they have to look at federal charges, possibly carrying a gun across state lines, a minor with a semi-automatic weapon, and even possibly the denial of civil rights to the two people that he murdered. It doesn't change the fact that the jury in Wisconsin was bound by the laws as they stood at the time of the incident, regardless of how ridiculous those laws may have been. Wisconsin repealed the self-defense law, is my understanding. So the state of Wisconsin knew that what was in place was wrong because it would allow things like the Rittenhouse situation to occur. Basically, what it boils down to is we need to walk away from this verdict and see whether or not there is another legitimate way through the court system to seek the proper outcome in the case.
All right, Victor, thank you for that call. April, I wonder if what you make of anything we heard there. I think, the caller mentioned the idea of carrying a gun across state lines. My understanding is that the rifle was already in Kenosha at a friend's house. So that seems to be out. Is there any afterlife to this case? Or, I mean, once you're found not guilty, is that pretty much it?
That's pretty much it, except for any wrongful death claims that may come in civil court. And because normally that you wouldn't see that you wouldn't see people go after a private citizen who wasn't a celebrity, because you're always looking for deep pockets when you file a wrongful death claim. And you wouldn't assume that an 18-year-old kid had deep pockets. But because he received funding from different groups, and because my understanding is he got a significant amount of money from various fundraising campaigns, if he has any of that money left, or he writes a book and goes on a book tour, which I would anticipate would come probably in the next couple of years, that those families might go after those funds, and it might be worth their while to file a wrongful death claim. So this may not be the end, and in civil court, the burden of proof is much lower. I did want to speak to the issue of force matching, force not being in the jury instruction. Sure. So according to the actual statute, it says the actor may intentionally use only such force or threat thereof as the actor reasonably believes is necessary to prevent or terminate the interference. So I don't know what the language of the jury instructions was, but that's what Wisconsin law is as to the self-defense claim, meaning if my goal is to get you off of me or get you away from me and keep you from harming me and you're using your fists, I still can't use an assault rifle to blow your chest out. So I really have a problem with the Rosenbaum issue. I did want to mention, though, that I think that the prosecution took the wrong route. I think it came out through one of their witnesses. I believe it was Gross Krauts. I always say his name wrong. His testimony Gross Krauts, when he used
the man who was shot but not killed, and he had brandished a pistol. Yeah.
Yes, he was the third victim who actually lived. And he testified and he used the term active shooter. And then that became a whole course of argument for the that he perceived Rittenhouse to be an active shooter. I think that whole line of argument was a mistake for the prosecution. I think it would have been simpler to simply say, so in addition to a right to self-defense, any one of us also has a right to defense of others. And so the fact that the two other victims witnessed Rittenhouse kill someone was enough for them to say we were defending ourselves, one, and that we were defending others around us by trying to disarm this kid who just killed someone in front of us. I think that's a simpler argument, a simpler way to explain it. Because when you think of active shooter, you think, we all think of school shooters. We all think of terrorism. We all think of different acts than maybe what we saw in the Rittenhouse case. And I think that it would be difficult for the average juror to equate this situation with that. And it's easier simply to say, hey, they had every right to defend themselves and to defend others around them, whether they knew them or not, to keep others safe by trying to disarm this kid, instead of making it seem like they were a bloodthirsty mob who was chasing him down, trying to kill him.
Okay, we're gonna carry this conversation after the break. We were planning to do another conversation. We're gonna postpone that one for a day because I think there's still some interesting areas to talk about here. And I know our guests have indicated they can graciously stay through the hour. So listeners, we do want to hear from you. 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st show. That's at 21st show. We already heard from Paul, who said, and we sort of alluded to this earlier, but he said the racial asymmetrical results of self-defense should be recognized, something like 9-1 in favor of white defendants getting off. We want to hear what you think about this case and the idea of whether justice was done and where was a failure of justice if it was not done. Was it in the court? Was it in the judge, the jury, the prosecution? Or was it in the Wisconsin state legislature and the laws that they have in Wisconsin? 800-222-9455 is the number to call. We're speaking with April Prayer, criminal defense attorney, and Mark Brown, columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. 800-222-9455. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are hearing your reactions and speaking with our guests about the outcome in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha, Wisconsin last Friday. And he was obviously, as you know by now, found not guilty on all counts. And we're asking the question, broadly speaking, was justice done versus, and what were the legal questions before the court? Is this you know, was this outcome inevitable, basically based on what the Wisconsin self-defense laws are. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. That's 800-222-9455. We're speaking about this with April Prayer and Mark Brown. April's a criminal defense attorney. Mark is a columnist at the Chicago Sun-Times. And Mark, I want to ask you, Rittenhouse is, it's already come out that he's taped an interview with Tucker Carlson that's supposed to air tonight. We're already getting little snippets of it. He says he's not a racist person, supports the Black Lives Matter movement. He tells Tucker Carlson in an interview that the case has nothing to do with race. It never had anything to do with race. It had to do with a right to self-defense. Obviously, Rittenhouse is white. The men he shot were white, but it was at a Black Lives Matter protest. What do you make of that, as well as just more broadly, those sort of the many figures on the right sort of taking Rittenhouse up as a sort of cause celeb?
Oh, well.
There's a lot there, maybe. I don't know.
I don't enjoy it. That's for sure. Anything that glorifies him, my wife and I talked to him. We wished he would just go away now, but of course he won't. And he will. There's everybody's looking for ways to profit off of him. Politically. And although that's going on both sides of the debate, right? People are raising money on the basis of being against him, and people raising money on being on his side. I think his mother went to a fund, some sort of big fundraiser in the week before the trial. I find the whole thing very discouraging as far as the state of politics in America. I'll say that. And as far as whether or not it was racial, yes, it did start out of a Black Lives Matter protest, and I certainly believe that a lot of the militia types, and I won't put Rittenhouse necessarily in this category, although I don't know, came to Chicago, came to Kenosha that night, thinking that they were protecting, businesses from Black people. I will say that. That's what I think, it was all white people with the guns on the roofs, right? Whether that was what went in Rittenhouse's mind or not. But you can't get around the physical destruction that had taken place in Kenosha over a period of a couple of nights, and that would motivate people to come out, not necessarily out of racial animus, just as I believe a lot of the destruction that was caused was not really by people who really were supporting Black Lives Matter, but were just anarchists. That summer, there was, a lot of people found ways to take advantage of the political situation.
Yeah, and we don't have the Kenosha reporter on anymore, but a lot of the reporting I saw out of Kenosha sort of made that distinction of peaceful or, mostly peaceful demonstrations during the day, carrying signs, chanting, that sort of thing. And then things really turning more violent at night with setting fires and things along those lines. And sort of it being maybe even two different groups. And we've heard that in a number of communities. Let's go back to the phones. 800-222-9455. Neil is calling from Arlington Heights. Neil, thank you for calling in.
Hi, and I have a question for the columnist specifically from the Sun-Times, who is worried that we are not respecting, or people who are unhappy are not respecting the work of the jury. And it occurs to me that over 100 years following Reconstruction and the Jim Crow era, we had lynchings, and the people accused of the lynching would be prosecuted, but the prosecution would be defective, or they were acquitted by jury nullification or discriminatory acquittal or whatever you want to call that doctrine. And so I'm just wondering why the columnist from the Sun-Times thinks that that might not have been operative in this case.
All right, Neil, we'll ask Mark to respond to that. Mark Brown, what do you think about that? The idea of, you know, there's a troubled history with juries, to say the least, in America. What gives you more faith in this one?
Well, I guess I believe that, maybe I should defer to April on this, but I have some sense of the people of Kenosha. They're just a lot like, they're a lot like us. It's a county that's like 50-50 almost Republican and Democratic split. It did bother me. I'm not sure if there were any African Americans on the final panel. You know, we never, like I say, I was never in the courtroom, so I never saw the jury, and that bothers me. But I don't think I have to answer for a lynching mob. There's just no lynch mob. You know, the jury in Kenosha, I feel confident, was pretty regular people, probably a cross section of the community.
Sure, sure. You know, and I know it can be difficult to sort of read the tea leaves. April, I want to ask you to weigh in on this, but my understanding is 7 women, 5 men, one person, one juror was black. And, you know, they did take, 30 hours or so to deliberate on the case. April, I wonder, what were your views on how the jury handled what they had before them?
I will say that because they took 3 days to deliberate, I will give the jury credit for being a thoughtful jury. You have some juries that make a quick rush to judgment and aren't back there 20 minutes. So the fact that they took 3 days means they had some sort of system, some sort of method to get through all of the evidence. And they probably looked at a good amount of the evidence. So for that, I will give them credit. Sorry about the phone in the background. I am always leery of juries that are all white or almost all white, just from my personal experience trying hundreds of cases. Especially if it's a case like this, that's a high profile case. And my understanding is there was one person of color on the jury, and I was, from my reading of various articles, again, I was not in the courtroom, and I never got the impression that that person was black. I just got the impression that they were a person of color. I didn't know if that meant Latino. I didn't know if that meant Asian. I didn't know what they were. But I think that when you have 7 female jurors in particular, and you have a very young defendant, that a good number of those women are going to see that person as their son. A good number of those people are going to see that person as their grandson, and they're going to empathize with him, and they're going to try to find ways to make sure that that person comes home. And I think that, and Kyle does look younger than he is. He has a fresh-faced kid, and I think that you're going to have jurors who are fighting for him. And juries do very odd things. I'm sure Mark will tell you that. I'm sure Deneen will tell you that. I'm sure anybody who has covered 80 court cases will tell you juries do very odd things. Some of it is not logical at all. And they are to bring their experiences in their own life into that courtroom. Every judge will tell you that. Do not leave your common sense or personal experiences at the door. And I think that that was certainly a factor here. And quite frankly, I don't believe that a jury of 11 white folks was going to let a 17-year-old white kid go to prison for the rest of his life. And they were going to figure that out any way they could to get him off. And again, I keep saying this is not a clear-cut self-defense claim. You never get a perfect self-defense claim where two people are the same height and same build and same age and same background, and they both put their dukes up and have a fist fight. You never get a case like that. It's always a little bit strange, but this one was so uneven in so many ways. The assault rifle just really made it a very unfair fight. And the fact that all 12 jurors decided to cut this kid loose on all counts tells me that there may have been some empathy and sympathy and some mothering and some other things that had absolutely nothing to do with the actual facts going on in the jury room.
Very interesting. 800-222-9455. I think we can get one more caller in. Terry is on the line from Melbourne, Florida. Terry, thank you for calling in. Thanks for listening across the country.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. And I just wanted to suggest that any of us that are interested in social justice, this verdict just sends shudders through anyone who would think about going out and demonstrating for social justice. I mean, it means a 17-year-old kid can come in there and break all kinds of laws in the process and get away with that scot-free. And, you know, one of the residuals to come out of this is that people who would push for social justice are not interested in going back to before 1960 or on into the Jim Crow era that leads back to the end of Reconstruction. And this cause that some of us believe in, and that is equality for people, whatever the risk, must not be abandoned as long as justice falls short of even one person of color in this country. And I think we were shoved a long ways back by that verdict.
All right, Terry, thank you so much for that call. And that echoes what another listener texted us. Katie said, quote, if you protest cops killing people, you get killed by vigilantes. Now I have to weigh the threat of to my life in protesting white supremacy versus doing the right thing of peacefully protesting. April, in legal terms, there are a lot of things this case, again, we've talked about this all hour, that it's not, right? Questions that weren't before the jury, but paramilitary groups are certainly viewing this case as a victory. Do you see implications for this verdict when it comes to vigilantism? And again, we just have about a minute left in our conversation here.
I do. I think we'll see more of it. We'll never see these exact facts again. You know, that's with pretty much any court case. But I do think we'll see more people who are emboldened to attend these protests, and not only to attend the protests, but to be the aggressor, to stir things up, to set things off. Whereas prior to this, that would have been pretty unusual. But I think we're going to see it pop up all over the country. And it may not always fall along racial lines, but everybody's going to point back and say, hey, that Rittenhouse kid, he got off. He did less than what I'm doing now, and he got off. And so they'll take the chance to start the fight, to bring the gun to the protest, to get way more vocal and way more physical than they may have before.
April Prayer is a criminal defense attorney based in Chicago. Mark Brown is a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. I want to thank you both, April and Mark, for spending part of your morning with us today on the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Brian.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. I also want to apologize and thank to our other guests. We're going to bring that conversation to you in the next day or two that we were planning about the holidays being, you know, it's a time for family gatherings, but there are deep divisions, as we've just been talking about all hour, over everything from politics to vaccines. Gatherings can be fraught. We're going to be talking with a pair of psychologists about approaching family dinners in this age of division and acrimony. That's going to be coming up later this week. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. We're produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Briel Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. You can subscribe to our podcast. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, NPR One, just about anywhere you can find a podcast. You just search for The 21st. That's The 21st. As I said, The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.